Our second case this morning is United States against Bradley. This is a certified case. The government is the appellant. Counsel for the government, you may appeal. You may proceed. You may appeal also.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Judge, with your permission, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes.
Granted.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Judge, and may it please the court, the lower court erred when it found that the trial counsel in this case should have been disqualified from further participation based on their exposure to immunized testimony. This amounts to a per se rule of disqualification.
Counsel, I want to first explore the waiver issue.
Yes, Your Honor.
And it was the government's position and the defendant's position that since neither party appealed that issue, it was the law of the case. And I'm just wondering whether or not it's the government's position that this court no longer has the authority to specify issues. Oftentimes, we specify issues that are not raised by either party.
Yes, Your Honor.
And it seems to me that you are now trying to get around that and say that we no longer have the authority to do so.
Sir, I did want to talk about that because the government's not challenging this court's authority to specify issues. What we're looking at here, I think the specified issue amounts to an advisory opinion based on the current case posture. And if I could just explain a little bit there. Typically, the guilty plea waiver rule applies and obviously precludes appellate review of any jurisdictional or due process violation, or any issues that are not jurisdictional or due process violations. We actually agreed with Civilian Defense Counsel that this issue specifically was probably the type of issue that would withstand unconditional guilty pleas. And I would just invite the court's attention to the joint appendix at pages 13 and 14. That's in our petition for reconsideration where we said we disagree with your finding, NMCCA, that a de facto conditional guilty plea is. We think this is the type of issue that would be would withstand unconditional pleas. But that issue needn't be addressed because appellant got what he bargained for in this case, and that was review on that specific issue. So,
is the standard the fact that an issue needn't be addressed?
I think our position in the supplemental brief, Your Honor, simply has to do with the fact that I don't think this court needs to go beyond the narrow question in order to dispose of this case.
But if this court decides that it wants to hear written submissions and arguments on an issue, why would the government then decide that it's not going to do that?
There was no disrespect to the court intended, Your Honor. It was simply that I think based on the current case posture, that issue needn't have been reached because it would be advisory in nature. I'm happy to discuss the distinctions between Menendez v. New York and then the Supreme Court's holdings as applied to the guilty plea waiver rule.
It puts us in a difficult position because we specified a specific issue on something that obviously the court felt was important, and neither party briefed it.
That's right, Your Honor. But where the case as currently brought to the court would render that specified issue advisory in nature only.
Should we allow parties, once an issue is specified, to decide whether or not that issue warrants briefing? Which I think is what we're talking about here.
I think that's well within the court's power, Your Honor. If the court determines that it wants specific briefing on that issue in the abstract, whether or not a disqualification motion would be waived, I apologize for not having briefed that initially, but we can certainly follow up with that. To speak to your, the thrust of your question, Your Honor, no, I don't think that a disqualification motion would be waived where it had been fully litigated at trial. I would have to agree with Civilian Defense Counsel in that regard. With that said, the lower court did in this case find that a de facto conditional guilty plea was entered, and so appellee's expectation interests were fulfilled. He got review on the issue that he thought would be preserved for appellate review.
Well, I realize you didn't submit any written submissions on this, but how do you square this theory of a de facto conditional guilty plea with Rule 910 that is very specific and was designed, I believe, to avoid circumstances just like this, to allow courts to say, well, de facto, we're going to allow this?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think, 910 is very specific. It's modeled after Rule 11 of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure. I don't know that the de facto conditional guilty plea would be the ideal vehicle for kind of obviating improvidency. concerns. Had the court actually found this plea improvident, we would have challenged the issue that the court specified, and we would have brought it up on those grounds. Mm. In all circumstances, I don't know that this would be the de facto guilty plea avenue would be the one that we would endorse. On the unique facts of this case, though, it got the job done, in that it allowed for appellate review. And beyond that, the lower court's finding, it was predicated upon this court's decision in Stewart. I think if the court wants to reject what NMCCA did here, it would have to implicitly or preferably explicitly overrule Stewart.
Was Stewart decided after 910 was adopted?
I don't know the question to that, Your Honor. I know that Stewart was 1971, and the CARE, United States versus CARE, was decided in 1969. So Stewart was well aware of the providency concerns that would be implicated. Notwithstanding, the court didn't find that it was an improvident plea, but it went ahead and reviewed the issue substantively. And that's what we're here to discuss.
I guess my question is, if your answer to the specified issue is no, then why not brief it and say it? That is, it's not, I don't understand specified issue 3 to be asking for an advisory, this court to render an advisory opinion. Rather, it's a fairly straightforward question that you see all the time in appellate cases. Was there a waiver of the issue of disqualification? If the government's answer and the defense answer is no, then we can evaluate that. If the answer is yes, we can evaluate that as well.
But,
so I'm not clear on why it's difficult to answer the question.
Because, Mr. Chief Judge, I don't think that's a fair characterization of the question, the specified question. It said, based upon appellant's unconditional guilty pleas. And as this case arrived at the court, appellant didn't enter unconditional guilty pleas. The lower court found that de facto conditional pleas have been entered.
Then isn't that part of the answer?
I think that's correct, Your Honor. No, it had not been waived because, in the case's current posture, appellant entered de facto.
Well, according to the CCA. According to the CCA.
Right.
But that's the question that we asked you. Do you agree with that? And then we get to decide whether we agree with it, right?
Yep. You know, there's the whole 910 matter. And you just blown the whole thing off and said, well, CCA said this, so we don't have to deal with it. I mean, you know, CAF, you go specify whatever you want to, and we'll do whatever we please.
Yes, Your Honor. If that's the case, then I feel confident representing Code 46 in the Appellate Government Division that in this case, the waiver of trial counsel, or the issue of whether trial counsel, that issue had been waived, it would not be based upon the minute exception to the guilty plea waiver rule, and that because of the fact
the
that
which exception?
Minute v. New York.
Oh, Minute.
Exception to the guilty plea waiver rule, that because this issue had been fully litigated on the record, that it would be susceptible to appellate review. This isn't the type of case where we would need additional facts outside of the record on its face. So I think that.
So it is possible to answer the question.
In a roundabout manner as I can, sir.
Thank you.
Moving then, I think the bottom line is whether or not it comes to the case, it comes to the court as a de facto guilty plea, or the fact that it would have been preserved ordinarily. If I can move to the substance of the review, and that has to do with the fact that the lower court did effectively apply a per se rule of automatic disqualification. The Fifth Amendment does not require that a trial counsel exposed to immunized testimony be automatically disqualified from further participation, and that rule has been that type of rule has been rejected in this court and in the federal circuit courts of appeal.
What should they have done?
The lower court should have made specific findings, or at least pointed to something in the record which would support its finding that trial counsel should have been disqualified in this case. And that's because there was significant litigation on the Castigar issue, but Castigar is retrospective. We're looking at whether or not the government made its prosecution decision or changed its strategy in the case based upon immunized testimony. The decision to disqualify is prospective, and we're looking at whether or not, based upon what the trial counsel knows, that there might be some type of potential for harm. And that requires demonstrable prejudice. This court in both Strother and then Rhodes has recognized that that can be shown by personal or financial interest in the outcome of litigation.
Are you saying that in order to have addressed the Castigar issue, they should have, that what should have happened is that proceedings proceed, they have to identify specific uses of the Castigar information in order to rule on the Castigar issue?
Well, no, Your Honor. On the Castigar issue, that was extinguished for appellate review purposes.
The prospective Castigar issue.
I think so. I think that's right, Your Honor. They need to identify specific prejudice. And beyond that, as the court did recognize in Rhodes from 65MJ, that at the pretrial ex-ante stage of proceedings, the military judge is afforded broad discretion on a motion to disqualify because it is difficult to pinpoint with precision the type of harm that might occur. The lower court pointed to none, in fact, and it compounded this error when it set aside the findings.
Do you think the Allen and Mapes language, which says that there's two parts to the Castigar test, one, the second part deals with the government's requirement to show that they've established a process to ensure it has not exploited the compelled information. Here, the record with findings seem to be pretty clear that the government didn't establish anything at all in terms of process to segregate. And so, in your view, is that immaterial to how the CCA ruled?
It is in this regard, Your Honor, that in United States versus England, which this court's confronted, and in the federal circuit courts, that the courts have almost uniformly held that the government need not compartmentalize or erect a Chinese wall in each and every case as a matter of law, that it will certainly make the government's burden harder on a Castigar motion, but that it is not constitutionally required. And so here, the government survived the Castigar motion. It met its heavy burden. And as the Supreme Court said in the Castigar case, that heavy burden provides substantial protection that will insulate from improper uses of immunized testimony.
But the CCA could not find that in the absence of any process having been established, the trial counsel could not have proceeded further because QED, there would have been a Castigar violation.
Perhaps, Your Honor, I think what the CCA recognized and
perhaps they could have done that and that would have been legitimate, or you couldn't do that?
Well, no, I think, see, the NMCCA would have been obliged to point to some demonstrable harm, at least in the same way that the potential conflicts are measured, if they rise to the level of a, like in United States versus Wheat, rise to the level of such a I guess, tangible threat to due process.
What about the trial counsel's statement on sentencing?
Which one was that specifically, sir? Was that the one where
607 to 613 in the record?
In his closing,
right.
Closing statement, Your Honor?
Right. Was that before or after? Is that covered by the post-disqualification or pre-disqualification?
That was the post-disqualification,
okay.
The judge's ruling.
Okay. And how do we know that that was not infected by Castigar immunized information?
Well, it may have been, Your Honor, but the defense did not object on sentencing. At most, if that were error, it would counsel for rehearing on sentencing, but not on findings. And again, if there was an error, it was not objected to on the sentencing argument. It was not objected to, and Castigar issues under 907 can be waived.
Was it not objected through by objecting to the counsel continuing in the proceeding?
It was not predicated as a continuing objection by defense counsel. That's certain, Your Honor. I guess with regard to specific concrete harms, the military judge did identify four areas that the government may have been advantaged by listening to Seaman Bradley's immunized testimony. And what the military judge did was he identified those, said, government, you will not cross-examine with respect to those, and this is subject to we will revisit this if that happens. Seaman Bradley thereafter pled guilty. There was no trial on the merits, and so that obviated any latent harm or any potential for harm. argument here, basically, if Stephen Bradley would have wanted to make something, he has to show concrete harm in the course of a trial. And by pleading guilty, it obviated the threat or any potential for harm. The last point I want to make before sitting down is basically just that the lower court compounded its error by setting aside the findings based upon potential for harm rather than Article 59A's actual prejudice standard. That standard has been recognized in Harris, in Serrano, throughout as being something that even in the guilty plea type cases, where there is a potential Castigar violation, that dismissal is not required outright, absent some showing of actual tangible prejudice. If there are no further questions, I'll...
We have an opportunity to have rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for the defense.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Lieutenant Brian Korn, and I represent the appellee, Seaman Willie Bradley. Pelley was denied his right to a fair trial when Lieutenant Keaton was not disqualified despite his intimate involvement in Pelley's case. Lieutenant Keaton's actions were improper as he refused to remove himself from the case despite mounting evidence that he should do so. The four most obvious examples of Lieutenant Keaton's improper conduct were, first, Lieutenant Keaton interviewed Pelley five times and was present during Pelley's testimony at MA2 Townsend's court-martial. Second, Lieutenant Keaton made no effort to segregate the information he learned from Pelley's immunized statements.
Is there anything inherently wrong with that so far?
Not until he then served as the trial
counsel. Okay. Thank you.
Second, Lieutenant Keaton made no effort to segregate the information he learned from Pelley's immunized statements from the rest of the information he learned in the case, and Lieutenant Keaton then refused to provide notes of the information he learned from Pelley. Third, Lieutenant Keaton improperly used Pelley's immunized statements to prepare the testimony of the witnesses in Pelley's case, which was a clear violation of this court's interpretation of Castigar and McGinney. And finally, and perhaps most egregiously, Lieutenant Keaton was not even assigned to Pelley's case until Pelley decided to plead not guilty.
Counsel, those all sound to me like Castigar problems.
Yes, Your Honor, and certainly...
Well, is Castigar at issue in this appeal?
Not directly, Your Honor, and Appellee recognizes the waiver of...
So the Appellee waived Castigar. Now Appellee wants us to decide this issue on the basis of disqualification. What case stands for the proposition that any of those actions on the part of counsel were unethical?
Your Honor, Castigar and all the cases interpreting it closely intertwine the issue of disqualification of trial counsel or disqualification of the prosecutor along with the Castigar violations.
And what case stands for the proposition that if none of those matters amount to Castigar violations, which is the posture we're in as a result of the waiver, they are nonetheless unethical for counsel to engage in?
Well, Your Honor, while Appellee waived the ability to appeal whether or not those amounted to Castigar violations, I don't think it prevents this court from determining that they did, and therefore that trial counsel should have been disqualified.
So you waive the ability to appeal Castigar, but the waiver doesn't matter because disqualification is equivalent with Castigar?
Well, it's not that it doesn't matter. Disqualification of an individual trial counsel is not equivalent with Castigar, Your Honor.
What ethical rule or norm, rule of court martial, did counsel, or rule of service, ethical rules, ABA rules, any other rule, did the trial counsel violate such that it would require the judge to disqualify him from participating in this case?
Your Honor, I would look to the various courts' interpretations of Castigar, and in those interpretations, courts do look at whether or not there was a Castigar violation, and secondly, often, whether or not a trial counsel or a prosecutor should have been disqualified from the case. The appellee's right to a fair trial in this case was substantially impaired. He was presented with an untenable situation where he had to decide whether to invoke his constitutional right to plead not guilty against a disqualified trial counsel.
He was represented by counsel at trial, was he not?
He was, Your Honor.
Did he or his counsel say at any point that his ability to make a plea decision was impaired by the judge's ruling on the Castigar, the disqualification issue?
They did not make that argument, Your Honor.
Didn't they say, appellant say expressly that he was pleading guilty voluntarily and of his own free will?
He did, Your Honor. They also did say that they believe they were preserving the disqualification issue.
Did they tie that disqualification in any way to his plea?
No, Your Honor. They did not specifically do that.
What has appellant waived in your view? Did he waive with respect, draw a continuum or a timeline?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please indicate what's been waived in your view and what hasn't been waived.
The Castigar issue of whether or not the government could even proceed with this prosecution was waived.
The motion to dismiss?
Precisely, Your Honor. The motion to dismiss. Pelley recognizes that if this court finds that Lieutenant Keaton was disqualified, the result is not dismissing all the charges and preventing the government from going forward with another prosecution. The remedy would be preventing the government from going forward with the prosecution with Lieutenant Keaton as trial counsel.
Why? In what way? There's two questions here, so let me try the first one. The government just argued that, in a fallback position, that at worst, the disqualification issue affects sentencing and not findings. Why is that not a correct position?
In response to the issue specified by this court, Your Honor, the government has argued that this was a conditional guilty plea. Now, the very nature of a conditional guilty plea suggests that there is no reason, there's no call for a contested trial. There's not going to be prejudice on the record at a contested trial in a conditional guilty plea, as the government has not only conceded.
Is it a conditional guilty plea?
It's Appellee's position that it was, and it's my understanding that it is also government's position that it was a
conditional guilty plea. I'm asking you your position.
Absolutely, Your Honor, okay. It was. And it's no different than a trial where the accused brings a motion to suppress a confession. If the trial judge were to deny that motion and the accused were to enter into a conditional guilty plea.
And how do you answer the 9-10 argument?
In response to the 9-10 argument, Your Honor, Appellee looks to Stewart and looks
at... Stewart doesn't say a word about 9-10.
That's correct, Your Honor, but Stewart does say that that this court or appellate courts can find, can treat a guilty plea as a conditional guilty plea when it's evident from the statements on the record by the defense counsel, that defense counsel and the defendant believed they were entering into a conditional guilty plea.
Has counsel waived Castigar issues with respect to sentencing process?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Are you alleging Castigar problems with respect to sentencing?
There's nothing specific that Appellee can point to in the sentencing case that demonstrates a Castigar violation. However, I think it's indicative of the problems in this case that trial counsel, Lieutenant Keaton specifically, was so tied up in the facts of Appellee's immunized statements that he simply could not separate himself from those statements. The truth is, Your Honor, we don't even know exactly...
So are you arguing a disqualification on the ground of prospective Castigar problem?
Not only prospective, Your Honor. Appellee has not been able to find any case law that says that the disqualification issue is solely prospective. Certainly, many of the errors committed by Lieutenant Keaton in this case took place prior to the time of the guilty plea.
That goes back to Judge Efron's question, which is what standard then has been violated or should have been before the judge on disqualification that he got wrong? He or she, I don't know.
Again, Your Honor, the issues in Castigar and the issues regarding disqualification because of Castigar violations are so closely intertwined that it's not a simple matter of separating them out.
So it's not Castigar, but it's Castigar.
Well, as the lower court said, that the trial counsel was disqualified because of Castigar. The lower court wasn't going back and saying this was a Castigar violation in that we can't go forward and retry Appellee. That many of the courts that have looked at Castigar issues, that have decided these Castigar issues, their arguments before them were twofold. One, that the case should have been dismissed based on Castigar violations, and two, that the trial counsel or the prosecutor should have been disqualified based on his or her individual violations of Castigar. And that's what we have in this case, the individual violations.
But you waived those in some respect.
To whether or not the case should have been dismissed outright, Your Honor, and preventing a retrial of Apelli. Apelli concedes that a retrial in this case is possible. The remedy would be to send it back to the trial court, not permit Lieutenant Keaton to go forward as the prosecutor, and to allow the new trial counsel to have a Castigar motion to demonstrate that he or she will not use any of the statements learned through Apelli's immunized testimony.
So you're not pointing to any specific use of immunized testimony by the trial counsel, right?
Well, there was specific use of the immunized testimony, as the lower court found, and even as the trial judge found, Your Honor. Lieutenant Keaton...
In the guilty plea case, or in the sentencing case? The case that actually happened?
Correct. Not during the plea itself, Your Honor, and not during the sentencing case.
So are you asking for a per se rule that whenever a counsel, that if there had been a trial on the merits, might have been disqualified, it is in a guilty plea, that we should kick the whole case?
No, Your Honor, we're not asking for such a rule. This court, pardon me, and all appellate courts need to look at the particular actions of that trial counsel regarding the facts of that particular case.
Can you point to the particular acts of the trial counsel with respect to the guilty plea case that actually took place here that are problematic?
Not in the guilty plea itself, Your Honor, but again, Apelli points out that the government has argued that this is a conditional plea. There cannot be such a violation in a guilty plea case, or I suppose there could be, but it's unlikely that there would be, that the trial counsel would make use of such argument in a guilty plea case. But
you still haven't told us what norm he violated. It wasn't the referral, because the immunity came after the referral. And what norm did he violate?
The norm under Castigar, Your Honor, that the government can't be placed in a better position than they would have been in had Apelli invoked his constitutional right to silence.
Now, what about the closing statement? Are you, you've just indicated that there was no Castigar problem with it. So does that mean you also are of the view that it's your burden to demonstrate whether there was a Castigar problem rather than the government's burden to prove that there wasn't? Seems to be what your argument is.
I apologize if I misstated that, Your Honor. The government does always have that burden under Castigar, and the problem here is it's impossible to tell exactly how the trial counsel used the Apelli's immunized statements. I think a very important point is that the trial counsel refused to even turn over the notes.
My question, which I hope the government will address too then when they're back up, is moving forward in the disqualification stage of the game, who would have the burden to show whether the closing statement was or was not enriched in some manner by immunized testimony in the context of this case, which is complicated by the moving waiver items, both specified and agreed upon? So there you are, and the judge has said, you're not disqualified, counsel. Please proceed. The closing statement comes.
Yes, Your Honor.
He says, blah, blah, blah. Are you alleging that contained Castigar information? I don't hear you doing that. In any event, who is the burden at that point to demonstrate that was impregnated or not with immunized testimony?
Well, Your Honor, if the military judge had properly ruled that the trial counsel was not disqualified, but had made the same statement that he made, that certain evidence that the trial counsel learned could not be used, and Apelli was then to allege that those statements had been used in the closing statement, then I believe the burden would fall on Apelli in that case. However, in this case, Your Honor, where it's Apelli's argument that the trial counsel should have been disqualified, and that the military judge was wrong in not disqualifying Apelli, Apelli has no way of showing exactly what evidence was used, what improper evidence was used in trial counsel's closing argument. And again, and if I haven't gotten this out fully, let me do so now, Your Honor. Lieutenant Keaton refused to turn over the notes he took when he interviewed Apelli. Now, as we know, the government bears a strong burden, the heavy burden, by preponderance of the evidence to show it's not using use or derivative use of the immunized testimony. Now, clearly, Lieutenant Keaton could not do that because he was unwilling to even try to demonstrate that. He was unwilling to even try to meet that burden. But because, Your Honor, we don't have those notes, we don't know what Apelli told Lieutenant Keaton fully. We don't know what Lieutenant Keaton learned from Apelli. We can't know whether or not that closing argument, that sentencing argument, contained elements from the immunized testimony.
Does it matter that you didn't object to the sentencing argument?
Again,
and if not, why?
Apelli believes that the conditional plea preserves the disqualification issue throughout.
Counsel, if I can try the burden issue again. In the Castigar issue, the burden is on the government to demonstrate that there was no use.
Yes, Your Honor.
That issue is waived. Everybody agrees on that. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Then the defense makes a motion to disqualify the trial counsel. The military judge could have granted that motion. He could have granted it either because he believed that trial counsel was disqualified or he believed that the risk of getting to this problem was so high. The judge denied that motion. Then, on appeal, assume that that is eligible for appeal, preserved, is not the issue whether the judge abused his discretion.
It is, Your Honor.
And under those circumstances, is it not the burden of the defense to demonstrate abuse of discretion by somehow showing there was prejudice at trial? One argument you made on prejudice was that it burdened his plea. Maybe it did, maybe it didn't, but he didn't say at trial it burdened his plea. You haven't pointed to any other burden either in the plea process or in the sentencing process. Why doesn't that show that the defense has not carried its burden in showing an abuse of discretion in this case, irrespective of whether there were any Castigar violations, those violations having been made? There may have been Castigar violations, but they haven't. The prejudice flowing from any of that hasn't been demonstrated.
Your Honor, Apelli believes that the prejudice was the impairment of his Fifth Amendment right to remain silent. The government, as I said, was put in a better position based on its knowledge of all of this information coming from Apelli's immunized statements than it would have been in had Apelli invoked his right to remain silent. The government had the opportunity to use all of these statements against him through witness preparation, trial strategy, decisions regarding plea bargaining. Another element, Your Honor, that Castigar looks to, particularly McDaniel stated that Castigar looks to.
Well, we're talking about the judge's ruling on disqualification. How does that relate to the Fifth Amendment right to remain silent? That is, don't you have to show some impairment at trial at that point, that something happened at trial that shows that the judge erred in allowing that trial counsel to continue?
Well, again, Your Honor, Apelli would fall back to the position that in a conditional plea, there's no way to demonstrate that at trial. It preserves the issue for the appellate courts to determine whether or not the military judge abused his discretion with the facts that were in front of him at that time, and whether based on that abuse of discretion, the guilty plea should be overturned.
So anytime there's a Castigar allegation, the judge has to disqualify trial counsel, that is, even if the judge rules that Castigar was not violated, the mere allegation of a Castigar problem is sufficient to disqualify counsel?
No, Your Honor. It's based on what Apelli believes were the egregious conduct of Lieutenant Keaton in this case.
Again, egregious conduct, which we may be repetitive here. You haven't linked to any professional norm that counsel is required to follow.
Your Honor, it's Apelli's position that the professional norms are set out in the Castigar case law. In all of these cases under Castigar in which the trial counsel or the prosecutor were not disqualified, or I should say in none of these cases, were the actions nearly as egregious as they were in this case. Lieutenant Keaton, his interest in this case and his involvement in this case went well beyond the involvement of any of these other prosecutors or trial counsels. And as I said, Your Honor, the, possibly the most egregious point, is it wasn't until and because Apelli decided to plead not guilty that Lieutenant Keaton was detailed to the case.
So what you're asking us, and this is certainly appropriate question, is for the first time to take Castigar and make it into a rule of professional responsibility for prosecutors.
I think it's tied up in that, Your Honor. The disqualification issue has something to do with proper behavior, but again, it looks to the specific acts by the individual trial counsel or prosecutor.
Would you address issue two?
The issue of waiver, Your Honor?
No, the issue of prejudice. Actual prejudice versus speculation as to prejudice.
Yes, Your Honor, and pardon me if I'm repeating myself, because I did attempt to do so. I think, first of all, there's no need to demonstrate the actual prejudice, or as the government states, anything that would occur in a contested trial, as the fact that this was a conditional guilty plea, and as I said, the government has not only conceded that, but the government has argued that there can't be such prejudice in a contested trial, and that's the very nature of a conditional plea. Aside from that, the prejudice the prejudice that Apelli would cite would be many of the things cited by the Eighth Circuit in McDaniel, that impermissible use of immunized testimony includes assistance in focusing the investigation, decisions regarding plea bargaining, interpreting evidence, planning cross-examination, and otherwise generally planning trial strategy.
But isn't this in some ways just another way of appealing the ruling on the motion to dismiss that was agreed during the province inquiry couldn't be appealed?
Chief Judge, I'm going to see that I'm out of time.
You may take the time you need to answer the question.
It sounds like
these
are all Castigar issues.
I agree, Your Honor, that the disqualification issue based on the Castigar violation and the Castigar motion to dismiss are very closely intertwined, and one cannot be separated from the other. The real issue, what it comes down to, is the remedy for violating the Castigar issue itself versus the trial counsel's behavior in this case. And the remedy is either the government losing its ability to prosecute at all versus the particular individual trial counsel not being permitted to serve on the case.
You may briefly conclude.
Thank you, Your Honor. In its brief, the government argues that the law cares not for trifles, and neither should this court. But the Fifth Amendment and the right to a fair trial are not trifles, and this court should therefore affirm the decision of the lower court.
Thank you, counsel. Does the government have rebuttal?
I did just want to touch briefly on the issue of whether or not this was a conditional guilty plea. I think it's pretty clear that the court's going to take my concession all the way and hold that this was, in fact, this issue was preserved and would withstand unconditional pleas. And that is consistent with our position at the very beginning. And again, I would just, if there is a question about that, we have remained consistent there. And that's in our petition for reconsideration in the lower court. That's at pages 13 and 14 of the joint appendix. That leaves the government and Mr. Gittins in agreement that these were unconditional guilty pleas, and that the trial counsel issue would have been waived. It would have been an exception to the guilty plea waiver rule. The other issue.
I'm totally confused too.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry.
State your position again. Right,
you got lots of time on rebuttal, so take the time and
we came to this court with a position that, based upon the unique facts of this case and the way that the lower court disposed of the case, that a de facto conditional guilty plea existed, and the government and appellee agree upon that, and so we ask the court to basically just analyze the lower court's methods and conclusions in analyzing the disqualification issue.
You do not believe that the appellant has waived the disqualification issue?
I think, Your Honor, I'm going to readily concede that he has not, but it's not, but he entered unconditional guilty pleas.
Then why did he waive it?
Because, Your Honor, I think in reading the direction of the court, it's going to take my kids.
Let me
make one point very clear, and I'm confident I speak for all my colleagues on this. when the judges ask questions, even questions that sometimes appear to be statements, it's for the purpose of probing counsel and assisting us in deciding the case. The case remains open, and all judges remain open to all arguments through the course of the oral argument. So counsel may not presume that we've made a particular decision in that regard. What the court wants to know from counsel is, what is the position of your party in this case on specified issue three?
It is, Your Honor, that this would have been the type of issue that would withstand unconditional guilty pleas, that the disqualification of counsel would be an exception to the guilty plea waiver rule.
And it's based on what?
Basically, the Supreme Court's holding in Menin versus New York that where an issue implicating due process has been fully litigated at the trial level, and the appellate court needn't expand the record on appeal or go outside of it where it can resolve that issue on the face of the record, that issue can be, or would be preserved for review.
So are you abandoning your position on the de facto conditional guilty plea?
Right now, that is our position.
And right now, what's your position?
The position is that the third issue, the specified issue, need not be resolved, that it remains unnecessary for the court to answer that question definitively because on the face, as the case came here, the lower court found that it was a de facto conditional guilty plea.
And you're happy with that?
I'm not allowed to speculate, Your Honor, and that is our position right now. That's correct.
So I'm still a little confused here. So you are asking us to say that this de facto conditional guilty plea is fine in this case?
In the facts of this case, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And the government is happy with the creation of a court-created rule that appears to erode 910 and is going to cause lots of problems for you guys in the future.
I think it's based upon this court's holding in Stewart. So if the court does reject that argument, we would ask it to all.
Stewart doesn't say a word about 910.
It does not, Your Honor, but by implication.
There wasn't any 910.
No, I think that's right, Your Honor. By implication, Stewart ought to be explicitly rejected for the reasoning.
Well, didn't Stewart involve a case where there was language on the record by the counsel suggesting that they believed that the issue had been preserved?
They did, Your Honor, based upon a misperception.
Is there language at the trial level in this case during the providency inquiry, the guilty plea, that suggests that everyone thought that the issue was preserved?
Certainly, yes, Your Honor. Pages 8 and 9 of the Joint Appendix, that's the lower court's opinion. It shows the plea colloquy between the Civilian Defense Counsel and the judge. And it appears that Mr. Gittins thought that this would be the type of issue that would be an exception to the guilty plea waiver rule. But he made very clear on page 9, it is an unconditional plea, sir. So he clearly thought that this was the type that would fall outside of ordinary guilty plea.
Or could we simply have a labeling problem here in which the court could conclude that there's no 910 problem because there wasn't an unconditional guilty plea in this case. That is, it was not a de facto conditional guilty plea. It was actually a conditional guilty plea based upon what the party said, and there was simply a labeling issue here. Is that a possible outcome of this case?
It would be a possibility, Your Honor, and if I could briefly follow up on
that. You can go on.
It would be a possibility, and if that had been the case, and the lower court had found that, we would have an improvident plea here, I think. And what we would have challenged at that point would have been whether or not this was the type of issue that was waived through a guilty plea. And our position at that point would have been that no, it is not, that it is the type that would be preserved because it had been fully litigated. In summing up, we would just ask that the court reverse the lower court's opinion.
Thank you, counsel. We thank counsel of both parties for your presentation today. The case is submitted, and the court will be adjourned pending further order of the court.